Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and this is the seventh and last installment in the series How the Supreme Court Rewrote the Constitution, 1937 to 1944. And this installment is entitled Concentration Camps and the End. This final installment addresses the court's role in what was, aside from slavery, the most egregious violation of civil rights in American history. It adds some observation on how the court's abysmal record from 1937 to 1944 continues to affect us today. In 1942, we were in World War II. Military authorities imposed a curfew on the populations of Western states. Curfews are understandable in time of war. This one, however, applied only to a single ethnic group, persons of Japanese ancestry, including U.S. citizens. Persons of German and Italian ancestry never faced curfews, even though the German saboteur episode discussed in the previous installment showed that the East Coast was vulnerable to attack. The evidence was strong that racism contributed to the distinction. Two additional military orders required that all persons of Japanese ancestry within those Western states both, first, remain at home, and second, leave the affected states. These two orders were obviously contradictory. Still another decree required all persons of Japanese ancestry to report to a civil control station. Civil control stations were centers for deportation to concentration camps. There, persons of Japanese ancestry, again including American citizens, were held indefinitely. There were no charges to answer and no screening procedure to separate the loyal from the disloyal. By contrast, the British used a screening procedure to test the loyalty of British residents of German and Austrian ancestry, and over 97% of those screened in Britain were released. But the orders applicable to America were all approved by President Roosevelt and indirectly by Congress. Gordon Kiyoshi Hirabayashi was a young natural-born American citizen of unquestioned loyalty. He violated the curfew but continued to live in his home. He thereby complied with the remain-in-place order but violated the inconsistent removal order. Hirabayashi was convicted of breaking the curfew and removal orders and given a jail sentence for each. The sentences were concurrent, which means they're to run at the same time. He appealed his two convictions and the case ended up before the Supreme Court. Hirabayashi versus United States was decided on June 21, 1943. Chief Justice Harlan Fisk Stone wrote for a unanimous court. He first upheld the conviction for violating the curfew. One would then expect him to evaluate the conviction for violating the removal order. This was important for two reasons. First, the removal order was far more intrusive than the curfew. And second, the only way to comply with both the removal order and the remain-in-place order was to report to a civil control station and be incarcerated. But Stone never did address the conviction for violating the removal order. On the pretext that Hirabayashi was going to jail anyway, he left the young man with an unreviewed and probably indefensible criminal conviction on his record. A federal appeals court finally overturned that conviction in 1987. In October 1942, Justice James Burns resigned to become FDR's head of the Office of Economic Stabilization. His replacement was Wiley Rutledge. Rutledge took office in February 1943. Rutledge had been a law professor, and as a law professor, he'd been an outspoken supporter of the New Deal and of the court packing plan. FDR rewarded him with a judgeship on a federal court of appeals. Rutledge served there for 4 years before the president sent him to the Supreme Court. Rutledge was thus the only one of Roosevelt's many Supreme Court picks with significant judicial experience. From FDR's vantage point, Rutledge was a good choice. First, Rutledge concurred with Stone's decision in the Hirabayashi case. Second, and more importantly, he supported the president in an abuse of authority so outrageous that even some other FDR appointees rebelled. Constitutional scholars of all political stripes agree that the case of Korematsu versus United States was one of the worst Supreme Court decisions ever issued. Fred Toyosaburo Korematsu, another young American citizen of unquestioned loyalty, had been convicted of failing to obey the removal order. On December 18, 1944, the justices sustained the conviction. The opinion of the court was composed by Hugo Black. That opinion, like so many Supreme Court pronouncements during this era, was laden with evasions, double talk, and outright dishonesty. Initially, Black purported to give Korematsu the highest level of protection, what we now call strict scrutiny. Racial restrictions, Black wrote, were, quote, immediately suspect and, quote, subject to the most rigid scrutiny. But then Black yielded up the young man because, quote, we cannot say that the government did not have ground for believing, end quote, removal was militarily desirable. Of course, a standard like, we cannot say that the government did not have ground for believing, is hardly the most rigid scrutiny. Black pretended that the order Korematsu violated was for removal only. However, Korematsu proved that the only permissible way to follow the removal order was to report to a civil control station. There he would be detained and shipped to a concentration camp without hope of release. Toward the end of the opinion, Black insisted, we deem it unjustifiable to call them concentration camps. Frankly, this was another lie. A federal court overturned Korematsu's conviction in 1983. Yet the Supreme Court has never overruled the reasoning in the Korematsu case. It lives on today as the first application of strict scrutiny to laws impairing certain constitutional rights. It also lives on as the first case in which the court evaded strict scrutiny, something that it has done too often when it tests constitutionally suspect decisions favored by the political left. For example, government race discrimination is supposedly subject to strict scrutiny. But as recently as 2016, the justices fudged that standard to permit state universities to discriminate against Caucasians and Asian Americans. The years 1937 to 1944 represent the low point, the nadir, in the Supreme Court's long history. The court had issued bad decisions before, some of them egregious, but never had it disregarded its fundamental responsibility to defend the Constitution so deliberately and so long. By the time of the Korematsu case, there were signs that the nadir was passing. The decision was not unanimous. Frank Murphy and Robert Jackson, both FDR appointees, dissented. Murphy's opinion marshaled powerful evidence that the military orders were motivated by racial prejudice. Also dissenting was Owen Roberts. After a career of waffling, his powerful indictment of the government's actions may well have been his finest hour. Moreover, on the same day as the Korematsu decision, the court announced the result in the case of Ex Parte Endo. The justices granted the petition of a loyal American citizen to leave her concentration camp after 2.5 years of detention. The Steele seizure cases were decided in 1952, and they were the clearest sign that the era of judicial toadyism was over. The court firmly rebuffed President Harry Truman's unilateral nationalization of the American steel industry. Hugo Black and Robert Jackson took the lead. Black wrote the opinion for the court. Black penned a memorable and much-quoted concurrence. The president, Jackson pointed out, was commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. He was not the commander-in-chief of the country. All this was welcome, but the Constitution had suffered enormous damage from which it never fully recovered. The present condition of the federal government is evidence of that. During the 3rd century, the Roman Empire was assailed with dynastic chaos, civil war, plague, and multiple invasions. It nearly collapsed. Beginning about the year 270, though, highly competent, hardworking emperors managed to work a recovery. Their efforts preserved the Roman state intact for another century and a half. Yet this recovery was only partial. This late empire was a darker place than its former self. Less prosperous, less extensive, less stable, less free. So also the United States. The Constitution that made American greatness possible has been severely compromised. Whether we fully repair it is our decision to make. We have no emperors to do the job for us. I'm Rob Nadelson. Thanks for listening.